Good morning. A sense of community that includes not only our fellow humans, but all the species with which we share this marvelous world will ensure that we fulfill our ultimate obligation and potential. And so our call to worship comes to us from Tennyson, who writes, "Come, my friends, 'tis never too late to seek a newer world."
Cigarettes, no sleep, no light, no sound, nothing to eat, no books to read. Making love with you has left me peaceful, warm, and tired. What else could I?
Today is more of a meditation. I'm going to ask everybody if you would be willing to take in a very deep breath and exhale. Let's do it one more time. Deep breath in and out. This comes from the Pueblo peoples. I add my breath to your breath, that our days may be long upon the earth, that the days of our people and of all the plants and animals may be long, and that we shall all be together as one. The meditation song. Thank you. A lot of you know that I live in the woods. Some of you have been to my home. I always want to say that I live in the woods and I went to live there deliberately, but I really didn't. I really went, excuse me. I went essentially because Graham and I wanted to get away from southern Westchester and the crowded roads and busy stores. But now that I'm there, thank you, now that I'm there, I think that my priorities have shifted and refocused. In the woods, I'm a resident among many, all of whom live on the 5 acres we occupy. I am one of 31 visible animal species. Each spring, I welcome everyone back from their winter naps, turtles, frogs, pheasants, and bullfrogs, as well as tulips, which I'm really waiting for, and the dogwoods and the cherry trees, oaks and maples, some of which are hundreds of years old. All of them, children of ancient lines, waking up, breathing deeply, the oxygen-based atmosphere that has kept us all alive generation after generation. Earth is ancient and vulnerable. Thank you. About 4 billion years ago, our planet Earth formed around a star. For millions of years, it cooled, and over time, the gases rose above this young planet to form an atmospheric envelope of what we call greenhouse gases that protect Earth from the sun. I'm sure most of you know all of this. Without the gases, Earth would be as cold as it is in outer space. But acting like the panes of a greenhouse, they keep the sun's warmth inside. 2.5 billion years ago, a group of microorganisms evolved a method of capturing light from the sun and converting it to energy. This process of photosynthesis transformed the nature of life on this planet. Little by little, generation after generation, these microscopic plants performed their solar-powered chemistry imperceptibly but inexorably, creating the oxygen-rich atmosphere we have today. Over an immense period of time, plants were established as the dominant life forms on Earth. And soon, there was life in the oceans, encouraging the growth of herbivore animals, and soon carnivores that ate them. For millennia, these animals and plants lived and died, piling carcasses upon the Earth's crust that decomposed. Ultimately, those chains of carbon became the fossil fuels we utilize today. Atmosphere stabilized with just the right amount of oxygen, which is 21%, to support life. At 25%, the air would ignite. At 15%, we would suffocate. So we've found this perfect balance. Earth has reached this fragile stage of harmony and stability after all this time. But over the past 150 years, change has been happening very quickly as human technology pushes the system. The photosynthesizing plants are crucial to maintaining the balance of oxygen and carbon in our atmosphere, but the carbon being released by industry and transportation is tipping the scales rapidly in favor of a carbon-based air quality. The plants and trees have been the breathing and sustaining force on this planet, creating a life-affirming balance of carbon, methane, and oxygen unknown anywhere else in our solar system. Now, this balance is radically threatened. How is it possible that we've created a crisis of such magnificent proportions? The current and impending fatal alteration of Earth's atmosphere is only part of the degradation of the planet in which we've taken part. Half the world's oxygen-producing tropical and temperate forests are now gone. Half the wetlands, 20% of the corals, 75% of the oceans are fished to capacity. Deforestation of the tropics continues at about an acre a second. And there are over 200 dead zones in the seas. 40% of U.S. fish species are threatened with extinction, a third of plants and amphibians, 20% of birds and mammals, and everywhere Earth's ice fields are melting. Species are disappearing 1,000 times faster than ever before. We are in an extinction spasm, and the world of nature is disappearing by our own hand. Ours is a moment of supreme crisis, presenting an almost incomprehensible emergency. And now, for the sake of planetary survival, ecological thinking has to become the hallmark of the new millennium. So much of the public discourse focuses on the small picture. And in fact, Brian Cole and I were talking about this yesterday over lunch during the Green Covenant conference. People talk a lot about protecting individual rights to property ownership, creating initiatives that can survive United Nations negotiations, things like bringing our own bags to supermarkets. And we're not acknowledging the massive crisis we're facing. Earth cannot wait. Our planet, our mother Gaia, which from her awesome beginnings has bountifully and mysteriously sustained the life of incalculable species, has been so violated and exhausted by her most recent offspring that her own survival is now in our hands. We, her youngest, most reckless child. The logic that led to slavery and colonization and the degradation of humans at various times in history is the same that has led to the destruction of the earth. It's the framework that suggests everything is in service to the dominant class. People who fight racism or sexism but don't extend the models of oppression to earth are supporting the degradation of the planet. And people who work for environmental sustainability but not socially sustainable models are supporting the dominant structure, which will ultimately defeat Earth, or at the very least will terminate her ability to maintain human life. The fight for justice is the fight for life in every form. The dismantling of the power structure of dominance is the dismantling of the same structure that dominates Earth. Systems that support the dominant structure can be defined as prejudice plus power. It's a use of power to isolate and exploit the other. This isolation and exploitation is grounded in the belief that one is more important or more valuable than the other. It confers privilege on the dominant group. Dominance is maintained by the legal, cultural, religious, educational, economic, political, environmental, military institutions. The pattern of dominant culture, the culture that created and supported slavery, that committed genocide on the indigenous people of this continent, that institutionalized the repression of women for centuries, has also approached Earth with a power over mentality and has fashioned similar results that reflect profound depression. Our instincts for social justice are necessary here. We need them in our fight for planetary survival. The circle we're trying to redraw to include people on the margins needs to be stretched wide enough to include Earth. Of course, the language of social justice, inclusion, and civil rights alone might suggest that Earth be given the same rights for which we fight for the oppressed peoples of our planet, which I think brings us to an important question. Do the trees have rights? Do the birds? Does the land? We can sense the tectonic plates of unsustainable commerce and insatiable consumption dangerously shifting beneath us. We realize in horror that it's not just an empire falling, but the platform of creation itself falling under the weight of our wants, our greed, our ignorance and arrogance, our waste, our need, our mechanization, our militarization, our exponentially increasing population that stands on the top of a food chain on the verge of depletion. Our planet, once the support of all life, now herself needs life support. And for the most part, until this moment, the generational cohorts of modernity, particularly our captains of industry and government, have been clueless. Now we face ecocide and find ourselves bereft of even the moral and legal categories to address it. And so, do the trees have rights? When I first read that, I thought, well, that's crazy. It's sort of an absurd question. While reading it, thought, this is some crazy environmentalist who's gone over the edge. But I have to say, you know, in thinking more about this, you know, my issue and maybe yours is the trees can't have rights because they don't speak for themselves. If they can't speak, how can they have rights? Of course, for millennia, the idea of women or children having rights seemed equally as absurd. They don't speak for themselves. They can't understand the issues, their property. Of course, universities, corporations, and states can't speak for themselves, but they have rights. And they have lawyers. They don't need to speak for themselves. Those rights have been defined and are protected. Property, of course, doesn't have rights. We get rid of property as expeditiously as we like. There are no questions of morality involved. If I want to sell my house and the 5 acres it sits on, I will. It's not a moral issue. If the next owner would like to clear that land, plow down those 200-year-old oaks and maples, he can. The only fight he might get is from my neighbors, because they have rights. The trees do not. Now, I'm not suggesting unlimited rights for every element of earth. Children, after all, now have rights, but they don't have the right to vote. They do, however, have the right to exist, even if they can't speak or participate in their own defense. An ethic of land would affirm earth's right to existence, to exist without interference. Our task is to convert our ethical categories to include earth as part of our community. It is to see ourselves not as vicar or conqueror, but neighbor. Each species has the right to exist regardless of its benefit to us. As part of the community, no special interest has the right to eliminate another for the sake of gain to itself. White cedar, hemlock, cypress, and other trees are being bred out because they take too long to grow. They can't replenish fast enough to make them economically feasible, so they are removed for faster-growing species. Lack of economic value is an issue for entire biotic groups like marshes, bogs, dunes, and deserts that are eliminated without thought when we decide we need a new housing development or mall or highway. At the turn of the last century, there was a campaign to save the songbirds. The argument put forth and seen as valid was that we needed the birds because they ate insects, and if we didn't have them, we would be overrun by insects. Bottom line, they should exist because there's a direct benefit to us. Not that they should exist because they are alive or because they're part of this glorious, wild, and incomprehensible system that is our planet. I believe it's Martin Luther King's vision of the beloved community that will be our salvation. It is our ability to recognize our dramatic interconnectedness, which is well illustrated by our atmosphere, by the air. I'm in partnership with 5 acres of trees and fields and ferns and flowers in creating breathable air. All of us on this planet are actively sustaining this delicate balance in our atmosphere. From our first cry at birth to the last sigh at death, our need for air is absolute. Every breath is a sacrament, an essential ritual linking us physically with all other beings on the planet, past, present, and future. Here in this beloved community, we are all caught in the same matrix of oxygen and the power of carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and methane. We exist in a myth of independence, as if we are biologically separate from each other, but in reality, we are completely dependent and permanently connected to the other. Inside as well as outside, we are minutely designed for the central activity of our existence, drawing the atmosphere into the center of our being, deep into the moist, membranous labyrinth within our chests. Can I ask you all again? Take a deep breath. In this sanctuary, we are breathing in the air that was expelled by others in this room. We very quickly absorb atoms that were only moments ago integral parts of the body of someone else. It's been calculated that every person over the age of 20 has inhaled atoms released in the first breath of every child born the year before. Chances are your next breath will contain argon atoms exhaled by Gandhi during his long life. We're breathing in atoms of air exhaled by Yeats and Shakespeare from the Battle of the Children's Crusade in Normandy, even of snakes and birds and every other aerobic life form. The longer we live, the more likely that we'll absorb air released by Jesus and Siddhartha Gautama, William Ellery Channing, the Neanderthals, woolly mammoths. And as we breathe in our forebears, so our children and grandchildren will take us in with their breath. We are inexorably members of this beloved community, each with the other sitting in this room, each with the other people in Yorktown, in Westchester and Putnam, in New York State, in the USA, with all the peoples of the globe, of the past, present, and future, who have breathed or will breathe our oxygen-rich atmosphere. We are members of this beloved community with the birds and the fish, the rocks, the soil, and the trees. We are the life that formed over billions of years, a life that has been sustained by our powerful, mysterious, and vulnerable planet Earth. And in our beloved community, we are that young, reckless child, and we hold the potential for death or the continuation of life. And so let's take a deep breath, adding our breath to each other's, and hope, as in that Pueblo prayer, that our days may be long upon this earth.